Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're looking for original, beautifully written books about time travel, workplace comedy, spy novels, and romance, I'm going to make things easy for you. You only need one book. The Ministry of Time by Cullen Bradley. Her brilliant debut novel is set in the near future. A government ministry is collecting expatriates to discover if time travel is possible. Cullen has done her homework and delivered a convincing case for the possibility of time travel. So convincing that the BBC is adapting The Ministry of Time into a six-part series. She joins us now to share the origin story behind her fascinating concept.
During the 2021 lockdown, I started watching a TV series called The Terror, which is about Sir John Franklin's lost expedition to the Arctic. So in 1845, Sir John Franklin took two ships, 129 men, to try and discover the Northwest Passage, and they vanished. All 129 men died in the Arctic. Both ships were never found, or at least not found until, I think, 2016 and 2018, we didn't actually find them. And that's what this TV series was based on. It's based on a book by Dan Simmons, who was also very interested in this story. And I became so fascinated with this expedition and with this TV series and its interpretation that I thought, God, I can feel my brain becoming crackly. I'm becoming obsessed. Because, you know, it was lockdown. My brain was cream cheese. It was sometimes TV programs are difficult to follow. But I went to the Wikipedia page. I read the summary for the first episode. And I ran across this name, Graham Gore. I hadn't actually noticed Graham Gore in the TV series. He's not a major character at all. He's not actually a major character in history. He's kind of a footnote, actually. But I thought, that's an interesting name. I'm sitting on my sofa. I can't go outside. I'm not doing anything. I may as well just, you know, click on that, find out who he is. I got to his Wikipedia page and I saw the photo. I saw the photo of him and I read his description, his biography, and the people who sailed with him tended to describe him as a very competent, very kind man, very, very good at his job. And I thought, God, I bet that guy would be great to have around during a lockdown. He sounds amazing. And then because I was, you know, this kind of fizzy brain thing was happening, I was becoming interested in this expedition. I was becoming interested in this very minor character from history, but I couldn't go outside. I couldn't go to any archives. I couldn't do very much research. I ended up finding online a community of amateur polar exploration enthusiasts who were very kind enough to share some of their research and their knowledge. And I started writing the first version of The Ministry of Time for them as a kind of joke, actually. Like, what would it be like if your favorite polar explorer lived in your house?
Yeah. I want to get back to the Franklin expedition for a moment because it is fascinating. And you've said that part of that whole expedition is hubris. Can you tell us about that? I was really struck by that comment.
Sometimes I think about this expedition with a kind of, I suppose it's almost fond exasperation, which is a ridiculous thing to feel about an imperial project. But these men went to the Arctic intending to discover passages that they weren't sure existed. They assumed it existed, and they assumed if once they found it, it would be very useful for the United Kingdom to have this passage through the Arctic. But, I mean, they went without an Inuit interpreter, even. They just assumed they would get there and it would be plain sailing. They wouldn't wear the clothing that the Inuit wore. They wouldn't wear furs. They wouldn't use Inuit-style sleds because if they started using Inuit technology, it would be considered uncivilized, basically. They wanted to take civilization with them. They wanted to take England with them and just transplant it into the Arctic, which is a ridiculous, preposterous, stupid thing to do. And I think, you know, really contributed to the fact that they could not manage their march across the Arctic to quote-unquote civilization when they eventually had to abandon the ships. They went out there just absolutely convinced they were going to be all right. Harry Goodsir, who was the assistant surgeon on Erebus, wrote to his father, "We've got so much in the way of provisions. You know, the ship is sitting quite low in the water. I have to rest my feet on them. So one thing I can say is that we definitely won't starve to death." And we know, in fact, that is what happened. It's just sort of preposterous to me that these men believed so much in the idea of making history, believing they were making history, that history was something that they could grasp, mold, and mold around themselves, that they just went to the Arctic and died there without thinking of you know, for a start, checking in with the Inuit to make sure it was fine to tramp through their homelands like that.
Yeah, there's hubris there. There's toxic masculinity. There's racism. Yeah, it's all very unfortunate. You mentioned that you originally were writing the Ministry of Time in the second person, correct? But you actually did write it. You changed that to the first person. And I'm curious about why you decided not to give your protagonist a name.
So there is a logic to that, and it is part of the fact that I was building her out. So when I first started writing the book, she wasn't British Cambodian for a start. So in the book, now she is a British Cambodian, mixed race, white passing woman. In the original version, she was sort of nothing. She was a cipher. And I started building her personality out and making her more specific, partly because she's a person who's falling in love and she's a person who's choosing to be complicit with a wider project. And I think those are two very personal things. So I needed her to be more of a person. But when it came to the names, she basically thinks of herself as the center of the universe. And the way she's writing this story is if she is just telling it to herself, as if she is the center of the universe. So she doesn't name herself to herself because she is herself. She knows who she is. But then there's a hierarchy of naming in the book. So there's people that she studies in great depth who she thinks of almost in the round, you know, like kind of 360 degrees. And these are the expats, the people who have been pulled from history, the people she is assigned to study. So they all have full names: Graham Gore, Margaret Kemble, Arthur Reginald Smythe. The next layer out are people who she doesn't think of in that same fully realized 360 way. They're people who she thinks of as characters in her story. So they only get first names, and they're people like her manager, Adela, her handler, Quentin, her colleague Somalia. Of course, all these people are not characters in her story. They're main characters in their own stories, and they are things that are happening for them out of her sight. But because she thinks of them as characters in her story, she maybe makes decisions about them, or she reacts to them in a way that sends her down different paths. And maybe if she'd been a bit more open to their experiences, it might have been a very different story for her.
Mm-hmm. Well, and plus you had lots of other things to think about. For example, the way you incorporate time travel in such an innovative way, how much cognitive bandwidth and, you know, did you have to endure? Did you have to use to figure out the time travel?
It was tricky. One way I think I did simplify it for myself, and I needed this simplification to make the stakes of the story work, is that it is a time travel novel in which no time travel happens on the page. It all takes place in the 21st century because the narrator is experiencing it in the 21st century in linear time. But we went through a lot of drafts, and my editors asked a lot of very penetrating questions about the stakes of time travel. Because if you can just move back and forth in time and fix things, What are the narrative stakes, actually? What do you need to change? Do you need to change anything about yourself or your way of connecting with the world if you can just keep rewinding and readjusting? So we had to place limits on time travel, but also just keeping the idea of different possibilities, different timelines straight was also quite tricky. And a lot of it involved me pulling back from the idea of time travel as a sci-fi concept and thinking of it more as a kind of form of narrative, really, as a way of handling time in a novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. And I think that's exactly what you did. You've said that you're really interested in time travel as a metaphor for forced immigration. I find that fascinating. I wonder if you could unpack that for us.
Definitely. So all of the expats who are pulled from the past are people who were about to die in their own timeline. And the ministry reasoning for this is that if you pull someone who was going to die, it doesn't affect history because they would have been dead anyway. They wouldn't have been doing anything. So it's okay to pull them. So they're all pulled from different disasters. You know, the Franklin Expedition, the Great Plague of London, the First World War, English Civil War, and so on. They arrive in the 21st century reluctantly. They didn't want to leave their homelands. They didn't want to leave their home eras. It's just that they didn't have a choice. They were going to die if they'd stayed. And they can't go back. So that's the important thing. Again, an important limit I've placed on time travel. They can never go back to their era. They never leave the 21st century. They have to experience linear time in the 21st century. The narrator of the book, her mother is Cambodian. So she would have left Cambodia and fled Pol Pot's regime in the Khmer Rouge in the same way. You know, she didn't want to leave Cambodia. It was her home. It was where she felt familiar, where she understood the culture, where she understood the traditions, but she had to leave because otherwise she would have died. So she, like the expats, arrives in 21st century Britain, well, 20th century Britain as it would have been, and is told, if you want to be here and if you want to stay here, you have to assimilate. And in both cases, both of these people, these refugees from time and these refugees from other countries, are told, if you want to stay in Britain, you've got to use the right language, you've got to dress the right way, you've got to prove that you can fit in, you've got to prove that you share our values. And that's the only way that we're going to say that you are British and you belong.
Mm. Yeah. Did you know that you were going to use time travel as a metaphor for forced immigration, or did that just kind of come up as you were writing the novel?
It started developing in the first draft, actually, because as I was writing the first draft, which was just the game and trying to think about Graham Gore as a human being, as a person, as someone who has emotional and psychological reactions to the 21st century, I kept on coming back to the research. I kept on bumping into things like his parents, because he has no grave, his parents put his name on their graves. His youngest brother named his first son Graham. And I kept on thinking, oh God, he didn't know any of this. He missed his family. He didn't realize they were all gone. And then, you know, thinking about the realism of that, of some what would it actually mean for this person to be dragged out of time and to have to adjust to the 21st century. Then that parallel became more obvious to me, this idea of forced immigration. And then when I was developing the Bridges character, the narrator's character, and I decided to make her British Cambodian, I thought there is a very clear parallel here. So it came out in the writing of the first draft and it was developed as I developed the story.
Hmm, interesting. You have said that your protagonist is British Cambodian, and you have said that you might be the first British Cambodian person to publish a novel. Assuming this is the case, what does that mean to you?
That's a good question. You know, no one's asked me that. Hmm. As far as I'm aware, I don't know if it is true, but as far as I'm aware, I think I am the first British Cambodian person to have published a novel in the UK. It feels, I suppose, I'm very happy to have contributed to the amplification of Southeast Asian voices in the UK. I very much hope that my being published means that there will be many, many more. I hope I won't, you know, I may be the first, but I hope the second is very, very close behind me, and I hope the third very close after them. I hope that it doesn't have to feel like an exceptional or remarkable thing. I hope very soon it becomes... It feels like it's a natural thing to say that you're a British Cambodian writer. I realize the diaspora is not very large in the UK in the way it is in the US and in France, but even so, I hope I won't be the first and only for long.
Yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed about that. Do you feel that that puts, for the length of time that you are the first British Cambodian person, does that put pressure on you in terms of writing your future novels?
That's a really good question, and I think... the pressure is mainly coming from me internally. I think if I feel obliged to be British Cambodian, to be somehow representative of all British Cambodian writing or all British Cambodian concerns, then there's going to be a lot of pressure. But of course, no one ever is perfectly representative of a single ethnicity or marginalized background. So if I think of myself as a writer among writers, I like to imagine myself in conversation with other writers of Southeast Asian heritage and other British writers, actually, and other writers who come from different marginalized backgrounds. So I think the way I take the pressure off myself is to imagine myself in broader conversation with so many more people rather than thinking of myself as an exception.
Mm, great idea. That's very smart of you to do that. The BBC is adapting The Ministry of Time into a 6-part series, and A24 is executive producing it. Are you looking forward to that?
It's very exciting. Alice Birch is writing the script, and she wrote the adaptation of Normal People by Sally Rooney. And so I feel, first of all, I'm in incredibly expert hands. I think she'll really get it. She'll understand the emotion and the psychology, and she understands yearning, which I love about her. It'll also be very exciting to see how it changes, because, of course, TV is a completely different medium to books, to novels. I think it will be inevitable that there will be expansions or changes, and I'm really excited to see where it might go. I'm also very excited to see who they cast as Graham, inevitably. I'd really like to see that guy.
Well, who, if you had input into it, who would you like to see as playing Graham Gore?
I genuinely have no idea. But one of the reasons I've become less and less sure, actually, as time has gone on, because now that more people are reading the book and have an image of Graham in their heads, I'm getting more and more people saying, oh, you know that picture of him? He did not look like what I imagined. And so I realize now there's a kind of version of Graham Gore that is completely separate to the historical Graham Gore, which I accidentally invented and is being reinvented by other people's imaginations. So at this point, I'm not quite sure who we should choose.
Right, exactly. Cullen Bradley, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on The Ministry of Time. It is an incredible debut novel. I can't wait to watch the series and to read your next book. And if I had the ability to turn back time, we would do this interview over again. But we're not going to go there.
Thank you very much. And thank you so much for your fascinating and brilliant questions. I really, really enjoyed this.
Cullen Bradley is the author of The Ministry of Time. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Dan Jacobs, Griffin Dunn, and Cullen Bradley.
What you're gleaning from these interviews is groundbreaking.
Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our technical director and producer is Steve Gotcher.
Steven, please pack your knives and go.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Adam, please pack your knives and go.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Doug, please pack your knives and go.